This is Melissa Bartell, the Bathtub Mermaid, and you're listening to Tales from the Tub.
Happy Halloween from the Bathtub Mermaid. Tonight, 5 stories for you. The first one is me reading a story called Bottled Up. The second is my friend Clay reading a duet for 2 young superheroes. The third is my friend Nuchchas reading Etiquette. The fourth is Jason reading A Piece of Midnight. And finally, I'm wrapping up with another story with Teeth. This is the Bathtub Mermaid reading Bottled Up. At first glance, it was an ordinary bottle. Clear glass with a matching rubber-tipped stopper to keep it airtight, apparently empty, labeled with a number, 36. She'd found it on the beach while walking her dog. Well, really, the dog had found it. He hadn't picked it up because he was a pointer and didn't fetch for anything. Even playing ball in the backyard, the dog would locate the toy, point to it, and if she didn't come to pick it up fast enough, look back with an expression that clearly said, "If you wanted it back, you should have adopted a retriever." So, the dog had pointed, and she had done the fetching. And the thing is, she isn't sure why she decided to take the bottle home. She didn't typically pick up litter. She should probably feel guilty about that, but she didn't. And she wasn't the type to collect beach glass. But something about this bottle was a little off-kilter. Maybe it was the condition. Old, sure, but intact, and pretty clean if slightly scarred by tides and salt water. It just spoke to her. So she took it home and left it on her desk, next to the mug full of pens to the right of her monitor. Eventually, she'd wash it out, maybe discard the stopper or leave it in the junk drawer and turn the bottle into a bud vase. She'd always liked using glasses and jars and old candle holders instead of actual vases. Days went by. She forgot about the bottle, but on the night of the full moon, she noticed a shadow inside, almost like a person. She held it to the light, but that didn't make anything solidify. It was still just a vague, shadowy outline. Opening the bottle was likely an unwise idea, but she couldn't help it. Just as when she'd chosen to cart it home, the thing was speaking to her. Only this time, the speaking was literal. "Let me out! Please, let me out!" She pulled the stopper, expecting the worst. A demon, maybe, or a trapped djinn. She expected her dog to start barking his fool head off, but he couldn't be bothered to leave his place on the sofa. And as far as she could tell, all that was released was some air that smelled of salt water. The full moon crept across the sky. She took the open bottle to the coffee table and stared at it. Nothing happened. The sun made its first appearance while the moon was still faintly evident in the sky, and she gave up and went to bed. Her dreams were bizarre that night, morning, whatever. They were filled with sailing ships, storm-tossed seas, rum-running, and cheating boyfriends. And then she had the feeling of being trapped and immobile. She tried to breathe, but the air was stale and swampy. And when she tried to sit up, she hit her head on the window. Wait, window? She opened her eyes to a sunlit room. But it wasn't her bedroom. It was her living room. But everything was oversized, and she couldn't seem to move from her spot. Realization came in the form of a demonic red eye on the other side of what she now recognized as a curve of salt-etched glass. The eye blinked, and suddenly it was blue, the same blue as her own. A hand curved around the bottle and lifted her up, and she saw the demon properly. But the horned head morphed into a facsimile of her own face, and when she looked down at herself, all of her color was gone. She felt small. She felt transparent. She was trapped. She tried yelling for her dog, but the fickle creature was standing next to her newly made double with his leash in his mouth and his tail wagging. He gave a single bark, and the demon with her face and body laughed in her voice. "Sure, let's go to the beach, boy. We should get rid of this thing." The demon clipped the leash onto her dog's collar and tossed the bottle, her prison, into her tote. When they got to the beach, the demon walked out to the end of the jetty and hefted the bottle once more. With a strong arm, apparently the demon had inherited her softball-pitching arm, and she threw it into the sea. The magical creature could have lasted centuries in a glass bottle, even in the depths of the ocean. But she wasn't magical. She was just a young woman who'd found a bottle on the beach. She was unconscious before the bottle sank into darkness and dead by moonrise. And the demon? She lived a happy stolen life in her stolen body with her stolen dog, as demons do.
This is Clay, reading Duet for Two Young Superheroes. Dashing through the streets, meeting goblins as we go, wearing contour sheets, wishing it would snow. Ethan marched down the street singing, the hood piece of his amazing Spider-Man costume dangling behind him like a cape. Well, more like a deflated balloon. He couldn't help it, though. The costume was a little bit too big for him, and when he wore the mask, he couldn't see properly. Besides, it was hot for October, nearly 90 degrees. He would melt into a puddle of red and blue goo if he had the hood on. He launched into the chorus of the song, his favorite of the Halloween carols they'd been learning at school all week. Trick or treat, trick or treat, trick or treat, we say. Try to get the treats before the ghosts take us away. Ethan trailed off, realizing he was singing alone.
Zach, why aren't you singing?
I'm Batman, his friend answered, trying, and failing, to make his young voice sound deep and husky.
Batman doesn't sing.
You wish you were Batman, Ethan retorted. I don't want to sing alone. You have to sing with me.
Halloween carols are lame, Zach complained.
You're only saying that because people keep singing other versions of the song to you.
Don't remind me, the boy in the Batman costume groaned.
This had been the day they'd all worn their Halloween costumes to school, and he'd been constantly assaulted with 8 to 10-year-old boys and some of the girls singing at him.
Jingle bells, Batman smiles, Robin laid an egg.
It had been funny the first time. Now it made him want to puke.
Why is it so important that we sing anyway?
Because, Ethan said, his bravado and cheer fading somewhat. We're turning into Willow Street when we get to the corner, and that means we have to pass that old white house, and Rebecca says it's haunted.
You mean the house with the tower thingy?
Zach hadn't learned the word turret yet.
It looks haunted. Like, when I'm riding my bike, I always cross the street so I'm on the other sidewalk.
Yeah, me too.
So if we're singing, won't that make it easier for the ghosts and monsters to find us?
No. It's like that movie. With the widow and the bald king and the kid who played Draco Malfoy, except this was before he was Draco. Ethan lived with his stepmother and older sister, who were both into musicals. He kinda liked them too, but he didn't really tell people that.
In the movie, if you whistle something happy when you're scared, you stop being scared. So if we sing while we walk past the ghost house, we won't be afraid of ghosts? Rebecca tell you that too?
Rebecca was Ethan's older sister.
Uh-huh. Either that or the noise of the happy singing will make them afraid of us.
They'd reached the corner by then, and Ethan stopped walking.
So, will you sing with me?
I'm a singing Batman, Zach answered,
in the same, attempting to be husky voice he'd used before. Ethan didn't twit him, though. Instead, he launched into the chorus, grinning, as his best friend joined in.
Trick or treat, trick or treat, trick or treat, we say. Try to get the treats before the ghosts take us away. Hey! Trick or treat, trick or treat, trick or treat, we say. If you don't have treats for us, we'll never go away.
This is Nuke Joss of the Nutty Bites podcast that can be found at nimlas.org, NIMLAS.org. The hissing of her serpent echoed in the stone chamber. He'd followed all the clues, the puzzle games on the open internet, the more difficult tests that came first through the dark web and then later through the mail. The mail. Seriously, who even used the postal service anymore? Well, other than Amazon and politicians anyway. But after months, years of Facebook friendship, Discord chats, and late night text marathons, he'd worn her down. I want to meet you, he said for the 70 millionth time. Find me if you can, she challenged. And he had. The legend said people froze because she was hideous, but she wasn't. She was power embodied, sinuous beauty, with eyes that could penetrate your soul, legs that were long, toned and tanned, and a voice that coiled itself around you almost as tangibly as a warm scarf. He couldn't help but stare. What? Forgotten how to use words? She teased. He could only nod dumbly. She rolled her eyes, all of them. Not just those on her face. It's not polite to stare, she said, a note of sadness coloring her tone. Didn't your grandmother ever warn you that your face would freeze that way? A drop of drool pooled in the corner of his mouth. She was right.
This is Jason Banks of the Talk Nerdy to Me podcast, and I'll be reading A Piece of Midnight. Don't leave me, he urges her. Stay with me. He opens the curtains to reveal the night sky, then lifts the window sash to let in the cool breeze. Impulsively, he stretches both hands through the open space and draws them back, cupped. Look, he says, returning to her bedside. I've brought you a piece of midnight. Share it with me. She puts her frigid hands in his. Her nails are blue, like her lips. A piece of midnight. I like that. Her voice is weak and thready. Her smile, watery, but her eyes shine like the stars. When you look up from now on, you'll see the missing piece, and know it's with me until it's time to be together again. It had been not really a joke, an act, he supposes, a bit, something to make her last moments a little less awful. When her eyes closed, he climbed into the hospital bed with her, careful not to get caught in the IV tubes and the wires that connect to many discs affixed to her skin to the array of monitoring devices. He whispers loving words into her ear long into the night. The nurses peek into the room, but no alarms are sounding, so they let him stay. In the morning, she doesn't wake. And it is sad, yes, but it's also a release from the endless rounds of chemo, from radiation that never seems to work, from pain and exhaustion. He grieves alone, and with their children. A week goes by, a month, a year. On the anniversary of their mother's death, he brings his children with him to the observatory where he works and sets the big telescope to the coordinates he has long since committed to memory. Just at midnight, they each get to look at the starry sky. That star right there, he says, is the one we named for your mother. That's her, looking down on us and wishing us well. The children accept his statement. His daughter, because she wants it to be true. His son, because he's young enough to still possess unshakable faith. But the boy startles them all when he announces, Dad, a piece of the sky is missing. What? Let me see. He thinks the instruments must be miscalibrated, but he looks through the scope and sees that, just above her star, there's a tiny space where the night sky isn't. It's as if someone reached above it and scooped out a piece of the galaxy. The years roll by. The annual trips to the observatory change. First, his daughter stops coming, then his son, and finally, the great telescope is replaced by a new project, and he retires. Good thing, too, because his joints just can't handle the effort of all the stares anymore. His daughter marries, has children, has grandchildren. She writes a cookbook of her mother's recipes and hosts a cooking show on some channel you can't get on the television without an expensive cable package, which he gladly pays for. He sees her on the screen more often than in person, but they talk for 10 minutes every Sunday. His son checks out of civilized life for a while. He sends postcards and video messages, surfing in Hawaii and Australia, diving off Tahiti, skiing in Switzerland. He has no clue how the young man pays for these excursions, but there's something about a YouTube channel and something else about teaching other people how to surf and dive and ski. On his son's 30th birthday, a photo he took graces the cover of National Geographic. It's a close encounter with a gray whale, and it's magnificent. Eventually, time wins out, and the children, no longer young, just younger than he is, are hovering in his hospital room. "Dad," his son says, looking out the open window, "that piece of the sky, it's missing again." "Not again," the old man corrects. "Still." They press the button to raise the glass pane and let in the cool breeze. Then they sit on his bed, one on each side. His voice is barely a whisper, but he's certain they can hear him. "On her last night, after you two said goodbye, I scooped a piece of midnight out of the sky and gave it to your mother. She said she'd return it when it was time for me to be with her again. I suspect the nighttime sky will be different after tonight." He expects them to scoff, but their mother had always seemed a little bit magical to them. And don't all the magazines and Facebook posts say that it's best to humor the elderly? The grandchildren and great-grandchildren come in to say goodbye. His son-in-law pops in to sit a while, and his son's partner too. But eventually, they all relocate to the family suite next door. A nurse will alert them to any changes. The full moon casts a beam across his bed, and in the stillness of his hospital room, the only sounds the soft beeping of the monitor and the hiss-puff of the oxygen machine. She appears. She looks the same as she had before she'd left him, before she got sick, when she was still a young mother and aspiring poet, her eyes sparkling with the light of 1,000 stars, and her lips are burning hot against his cheek when she kisses him. "I've come to return this," she says, and lifts his hands. Then she cups her own hands together and pours a piece of midnight into them. "This allowed me to watch over you and the kids, and it keeps us connected. But now it's time to restore it to its rightful place. And since you took it, only you can put it back." She climbs onto the bed and curls herself around him. But while her voice is low, she doesn't whisper words. Instead, she sings songs of distant planets and spiraling galaxies. She shares ballads about the untold wonders of the universe and anthems to the joys of space and time. Finally, as morning light begins to color the edges of the horizon, she sings a lullaby about putting stars to sleep. His last breath comes as the final note is dying out. The children and their partners, the grandchildren and great-grandchildren, all file into the room for one last look before his body is sent away. There will be a funeral later, and then they'll mix his ashes with hers and cast them to the winds from the top of Observatory Hill. But all that day and into the night, they keep a vigil in his living room. More distant relatives come and go. Food is served, forgotten, reheated, and finally eaten. They tell stories, laughing and crying, and remembering all the details that get pushed aside by busy lives. When it is midnight again, his son and daughter slip away to spend a quiet moment with the night sky. "Look," says his son, pointing to their mother's star. "Look." In the place where a piece of midnight has always been missing, stars shine brightly down.
This is the Bathtub Mermaid reading with teeth. "Bite me," I ask him in the middle of one of our late Saturday afternoon romps in the sheets. "Please." "No, I can't." "You can." I turn my head, baring the side of my neck to him. He knows the spot I mean, the juncture of neck and shoulder. "I'm not asking you to draw blood." "Don't say that," he says. "Don't even think it." He hesitates, nuzzles the spot in question while his hand cups my breast and his thumb tweaks the nipple. Beneath him, I give a slight jolt. "Please, I'm not begging." "Exactly." "Honey, I can't." He meets my eyes when he says it, urging me to understand, and I do, but that doesn't stop the wanting. Still, he lowers his head to my neck again and licks. It's not a bite, but it's almost as good. Oh, God. Our afternoon encounter escalates from there until we're both satisfied and sleepy. We curl up together and nap. When I wake, the room is completely dark instead of merely dim, and he is gone from the bed. I hear movement in the kitchen. He's opening a bottle. I can smell the contents. Wearing the t-shirt he'd cast off much earlier, I pad out of the bedroom on bare feet. He doesn't hear me coming. I know this because he starts when I slide my hands around his waist from behind and lay my head against his shoulder. You're cold as ice, he says. You're hungry. I'm always hungry. After. I reach around him and grab the bottle from his far hand, then take a swig. Not bad, I say. Tastes like a 99. Maybe a 2000. Virgin? Virgin, he confirms. 2000 Carpathian blend. Shall I heat it for you? Please. I go to the couch and wrap a cotton throw around my legs. He joins me a few minutes later, handing me my favorite mug, a smiley face with fangs, full of steaming liquid. For himself, he's got scrambled eggs and a hamburger patty. He says protein is essential. Full moon tonight, I comment after checking an app on my phone. You going out with the guys? Do you mind if I do? I shake my head. Nope. Francesca and Catherine and I have plans to see a late movie. Home by dawn? Home by dawn. I come home from my Saturday night with the girls to find that he's home early. Everything okay? I ask, stripping off my clothes and climbing into bed with him. He answers with a sly smile. Everything's fine. I just kept thinking about earlier, about how you like it with teeth, about how I couldn't give you what you wanted. You mostly did, I assure him. I can give you more than mostly now. I reach out to touch him under the covers and find a fine coating of hair. He's in his between state, holding it for me. This is the only time he can bite me and neither turn me nor be turned. It's a brief window we have in the last moments before dawn, 3 days a month. But I'll take it. We'll take it. Such is life when you're a vampire married to a werewolf and you both prefer your horizontal recreation with teeth.
Opening and closing music is a mix of Chris Zabriskie's The Oceans Continue to Rise from the Free Music Archive and a clip of whales singing off the coast of French Polynesia provided by Kivoy to freesound.com. The Bathtub Mermaid, Tales from the Tub, is written and produced by Melissa A. Bartel and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike 4.0 International license. For detailed show notes, including my contact information, please visit my website at bathtubmermaid.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, never let your bathwater get too cold.